European Union has not treated us well.
Stupid European elites jumping off the cliffs once again.
Yes, you are the guilty people, and you refuse to accept it.
This is EU Scream, the progressive politics podcast from Brussels. I'm James, a journalist who's crisscrossed Europe for 15 years now, covering politics and the economy.
I'm Tom. I've been a lobbyist and spin doctor in Brussels for many years, and I've spent the last decade fighting climate change.
In this episode, Heather Graby of the Open Society European Policy Institute says populists are closing the minds of Europeans to the wide range of values they still have in common. She says new survey findings across six EU countries should embolden centrists to drop their wishy-washy approach and directly confront the dangers of creeping authoritarianism. First, we hear from Sundas Boualem, a Moroccan working at the European Parliament. She talks about dealing with prejudice, curbing stereotypes, and her project to give the unloved EU a human face. Sundas, great to have you on the show.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you work in the European Parliament as a parliamentary assistant?
Yes, indeed, to a Slovak member of the European Parliament.
And you also have created Humans of the EU, which sounds a lot like Humans of New York, but we're talking about Humans of the EU.
Yes. Well, actually, Humans of the EU was inspired by Humans of New York. I thought it was a really cool project to take photos of people. So what he's doing is he's taking photos of people in the streets of New York to tell their personal stories. And the inspiration from that is that I take photos of people who work within the EU bubble. So in Brussels, and I tell their stories. Sometimes their stories are about their work related to the EU. Sometimes it's more about positive stories or anything they want to tell me.
Tom, this is a project you've always wanted to do, right?
Really? You wanted to do Humans of the EU? What?
James is slightly taking the mick out of my possibly slightly cynical view of a lot of the way that the bubble operates. But I've been in the bubble for a very long time. What's the best, what are your favorite stories that you've heard?
Wow, there are so many of them. That's why people should go read the stories.
Yeah, give us the URL that people should
It's humansoftheeu.com.
Humansoftheeu.com.
Yes.
And I mean, the thing I find really fascinating about the project is when you start to think about the types of people and the incredible variety of people, like the zoo that is the EU bubble, the animals in it are really interesting, actually. Mm. And you get people from super different backgrounds, obviously different national identities and whatever, but very different cultural backgrounds, coming out from very different places, very different politics. Is that coming through in your research and in your discussions?
It is coming through, yes and no, because actually, well, now it's been exactly 1 year that I've been doing it. But I'd say that at least I hope that through writing these stories and interviewing these people, such categories and stereotypes actually disappear a little bit, because what I've noticed through my experience in this bubble is that, on the contrary, the fact that all these people from across Europe are gathered together and creating something idealistic together makes these categories disappear a little bit. And I'm optimistic, but I don't know.
And you are, like you say, you're Moroccan.
Yes.
And you might be the first Moroccan to have been employed by the European institutions?
That's what the Embassy of Morocco told me, apparently, that I'm the first person with a Moroccan passport. So, because I think before, many people thought that a non-European could not work for the EU, because that's stated in the rules as well. But the parliament has made an exception since years. So there has been an Argentinian, now there is me. It's fairly recent, but yes, I'm the first.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty impressive.
Thank you. I hope I represent Morocco well.
Brilliant. Because your point about national barriers, obviously, national stereotyping is alive and well and living in the British press. For example, you know, and if you just look at the Brexit debate, right, and how Michel Barnier always gets described in some way, which is kind of slightly disparaging about French people. He's often described as being, you know, very well-dressed,
He is. I interviewed him, and he was very well dressed.
He is super well dressed.
But there's some chill Saturday.
Oh wow, brilliant!
Yeah,
he's a very dapper gentleman. But also, like, when you see that in the British press, there's something about how he's this kind of sort of slightly slick French guy. Certainly when the British talk about the Germans, there's always a bit of kind of don't mention the war in there somewhere. And there's always a bit of, you know, they're kind of super technical and very process oriented. And, you know, there's been a lot of stuff about how Angela Merkel won't negotiate because she's German.
And now, as ever, to the papers. If you look at the front page, it really is one story above all. There's the Sunday Borisograph. Boris, how EU wants a super state as Hitler did. The Sunday Times.
Adolf Hitler said he wanted a united Europe.
But
so he was a Nazi, was he? Yes, and she wants a united Europe, am I right?
Obviously, those stereotypes are not useful. Do you find that are they still hanging around in the debate here in Brussels, or are they really kind of gone? Where are the divides? Like, how do people group themselves?
It is true that there, at the European Parliament especially, you find people that remain within their own delegation. So, for example, I work for the Socialists and Democrats, and then you have a big German delegation. They often hang out with each other. They often do things together. But I think that this is just a matter of being away from where they're from and in another city. I don't think the EU created these groupings or these nationality groupings. As for stereotypes, I think they have a bit of truth in them. I don't get easily offended if people make a nice joke, let's say, about being Moroccan. I get offended if they get stuck onto a stereotype and just summarize me to that. Then that's the difference. So if you say that the British media make fun a bit of Germans or other nationalities at times, as long as it's friendly, this is fine. We cannot deny that we are different and that our cultures are different. Like, but when it comes to typologizing people too much and just reducing them to that, that's the danger.
And when you studied in, I think it was in Edinburgh and Cambridge, you know, what was the kind of typologizing that went on in the university environment versus maybe the Brussels environment?
At university, both in Edinburgh and Cambridge, and then in parallel in Brussels, these were all and are environments that are very cosmopolitan. But in the meantime, I also lived for 5 months in Vienna, Austria, in 2015, in the midst of when the migrants and refugees crisis was really over-mediatized and scaring a lot of people, I suppose. And there I felt a bit discriminated. Not by the people I worked for, but in daily life, I suppose, because I don't speak German, so I didn't really make that many local friends, and I got hit by a lady in the subway once, an old lady. Yes. But this old lady randomly hit me with her back in the subway and shouted something in German. And then I got a bit, I was just very shocked and I left. It just shows that what hate can do to people and what ignorance can do to people on a daily basis.
That's an instant judgment in this woman's head, essentially.
You just saw an Arab and
how you look, right? Purely, right? Bang, right? With no second thought, no, just, it goes to show how effective the propaganda is, right? Like how deep into a person that's sunk to get to that.
And what
that
hate
point.
Can do to human beings.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-mm. And it's interesting, actually, because you do, like, young Moroccan origin guys on the metro in Brussels with their hoodies up, with their hoods up on there, and the hoodie, and you see, right? Couple of those kids, 16, 17, whatever, get on the metro and there's a little space opens up around them.
That's
right?
True.
And you
especially
see
after
stuff.
The attacks, I've noticed that.
Right,
whoa.
Right.
Yes.
You're right. You see that. And so this kind of stereotyping, the impact of that kind of stereotyping is very, very real. Well, sorry you had to experience that.
Do you know what she yelled in German?
No, I don't, but it sounded insulting from the tone, sure. And I just saw that people around us looked at the scene in shock, but I left immediately, because I just didn't want to stay and confront that situation.
And without being overly stereotypical, most things said in Austrian German sound pretty insulting.
conforming to British stereotype, as usual. Yeah, very good.
I'm here all week.
I think this was a one-time incident, but such incidents show the growing of hate in Europe, maybe towards migrants, refugees from certain nationalities, I suppose. But in Brussels, actually, I've had a really nice experience so far. And I feel maybe almost half of the people who live here are actually foreigners. And that's what creates the fact that we're all just here.
I think it is actually literally half.
Literally?
Yeah.
Okay,
I think it is, I think it is 50% of the city essentially are non... Well, many of them have now become Belgian nationals.
Tom already got his passport.
Congratulations. Nice.
I'm on my way. Inshallah.
Nice. Yes.
This will be the third week of March,
oh, cool.
Which is rather close to March the 29th.
Mm.
Which is Brexit Day.
Which is Brexit Day.
as if we had forgotten.
Which is cutting it pretty fine. But I'm hoping.
Not quite as fine as Theresa May.
No. Yeah. No. Indeed. No, she's a past master at the cliff edge.
Yeah, is she fine? She just always looks very composed, but I'm a bit worried that she's not that fine.
It's a really interesting thing, actually. There is a part of me, and I think an increasing number of people, actually, who feel quite sorry for her. Because she doesn't look well. Let's face it, she's not a natural colour. all the blood is kind of drained out of her face, and she looks incredibly tired and very harried and like she's not having a great time. But then again, you know, she could just go and revoke Article 50 and it would all be over.
Or she could have told the truth when she took over the prime ministership and said, actually, we can't. Right. You know, you can't have your cake and eat it.
Right.
So she's been lying for 2 years.
Right. But maybe she's been believing those lies. I mean, coming back to when I was living in Scotland and England, she was Home Secretary. And as soon as I got there, the laws towards students, not just immigrants in general, got tightened up a lot. And then I thought, whoa, she really doesn't want people in here.
Absolutely.
Maybe it's also her mentality. I don't know.
I mean, she was the creator of a lot of the problems that have beset immigrants into the UK over the last 20 years.
What's broadly called the hostile environment.
The hostile environment policy, creating a hostile environment for immigrants. That was stated government policy.
And this is not just about making the UK a more hostile place for illegal migrants. It is also about fairness.
How actually did it manifest when you were a student?
Once I became a student, every 4 or 5 months or so, I had to go to the police to get a check that my papers were in order, that I was allowed to be there. But I think, I don't know, for a young person going through that every few months or so, like they're criminals or they're doing something wrong, that's just not a feeling that makes you feel welcome and like you could stay there.
And that was both in Edinburgh and in Cambridge.
Yes.
Wow. Okay.
And we do have this hate growing up inside the EU. And you told the story about the old lady hitting you on the metro in Austria. Obviously, you're now starting to get elements of that very negative and fear-based and hate-filled view of the world actually making its way inside the Brussels bubble. Are you getting a greater sense of the kind of more politicized nature of what's happening here?
Oh, no, it's very politicized. And also I work at the European Parliament. So I guess I feel this already fear from certain political groups that in the next mandate, the far right will have a bigger place than it has now. And it's difficult because we all want to fight it, but at the same time, they're very motivated in all of their communication. People there, I mean, that vote for those parties generally are people who motivate themselves to vote. And that's why I think the antidote to this is that instead of hating back on them, then we should just motivate ourselves to spread awareness on the fact that this is a problem and that there are still people who are British and don't want Brexit to happen or still believe in the European ideal. Let's go to vote. Let's do this together. For example, I don't really understand when populists have this narrative of, oh, okay, people who work for the EU are an elite or they're people that you can't really relate to. They speak different languages. They went to amazing schools. This is true of any prestigious organization in the world. And this is true of politics all over the world. Why don't people look at the politics in their own member states? Do they think politicians there have inexpensive lunches and don't wear suits in their own parliaments? Like, no, this is true all over the world. So the EU, on the contrary, maybe is reproducing this model, but at least with the ideal belief that we're working towards something bigger and that will be different for everyone.
I also think it's really interesting that given that environment, the challenges that the EU seems to be endlessly going through and are possibly about to get a lot worse, It's very interesting that the power of attraction is still there for ambitious, smart people from the countries in the neighborhood. Morocco. Presumably, did you always think that you would sort of end up in Brussels, or was that your goal?
I definitely knew that I wanted to go to Europe. I grew up in Morocco, but the moment I was 18, I wanted to go study abroad, experience a different lifestyle. I always saw Europe as this beacon of freedom and enlightenment and, yes, studying, working hard, doing things together, having opportunities. And this is what the haters are trying to destroy, because they don't want to be part of this beautiful, enlightened community. They want to stay stuck in history or in days of glory that cannot be brought back. So if people are enlightened through information, through awareness, like what you guys are doing through this podcast, or what I hope to do through my project, then they will get this sense of hope again and want to fight harder.
I feel really privileged to be hearing that from somebody who is not yet a European with a European passport. So Sundus, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Heather Graby is the director of the Open Society European Policy Institute, part of the network of organizations set up by George Soros, the billionaire born in Hungary, to support democracy worldwide. Heather says a new survey across six countries carried out by the Institute shows that a hidden majority of Europeans hold fast to values like freedom of expression and the rule of law. The survey also covers Hungary, where Prime Minister Viktor Orban is centralizing power, curbing civil liberties, and frequently demonizing Mr. Soros himself. The implication of the Institute's research is that, amid the mixed and often contradictory views held by Europeans, there's a great deal more common ground than leaders like Orban or political bosses like Jarosław Kaczynski of Poland say that there is. Centrists and moderates can regain ground from populists by talking in clear and everyday terms about values that citizens deep down care about, Heather says. There's still everything to play for here, she emphasizes. I first asked her for more details on the study called Voices on Values.
The whole point of doing Voices on Values was to find out what really Europeans really think about values. There's a lot of talk in the press, there's a lot of talk, particularly by populist politicians, about people not caring about values anymore. So we wanted to find out if people do still care about values like freedom of expression and media freedom, and whether they're prepared to trade off those values against other things like economic security and political stability. So we did this survey in six countries across Europe, so Greece, Hungary, Poland, Italy, France and Germany, and found out some really interesting results, and ones that really buck the trend of saying, well, people don't care about values anymore.
What are your top line findings about majorities in most of the EU countries studied?
They really care about European values. 91% consider the values that are in Article 2 of the Treaty on European Union, like freedom of expression, media freedom, rule of law, to be essential for a good society.
Why on earth don't people in Europe treat Article 2 of the treaties like the Bill of Rights in the US? Why didn't that happen?
It's amazing how Article 2 has been neglected. It's the Cinderella of the treaties because it doesn't have that much power. There aren't big enforcement powers attached to it, like in, say, competition policy, for example, or even the fiscal rules that now apply in the EU. But they are the fundamental values which most people in Europe actually hold dear. They're also the ones that are in most countries' constitutions. But somehow they were kind of taken for granted, especially during the Cold War and immediately afterwards in the euphoria of the 1990s. There was an assumption that these values underpin a democratic society and also underpin prosperity, and therefore everybody would always love them forever. Now they're increasingly contested, but actually Europeans still hold them dear.
And when did they enter into the treaties? Are they a coal and steel community era thing? Are they a Maastricht thing? Are they a Lisbon thing?
So the Article 2 as it is now is in the Lisbon Treaty. But in fact, there were previous versions of this article in previous treaties. So the current formulation is of values as of today. But in fact, you find antecedents that go all the way back. Some have gained more prominence, like gender equality, for example. But these are the fundamentals that even the founding fathers of the United States promoted.
Okay, now back to Voices on Values. Are these findings really a reason to hope, since the transition to democracy in Central and Eastern Europe does not seem to be an inevitable process anymore, and at a time when liberal democracy still is flailing to counter the rise of nationalist populism in Western Europe? Make us optimistic about what you've found, given the bleak environment in which we find ourselves.
Yeah. Despite what many populist politicians in Europe claim, the overwhelming majority of Europeans still cherish the values that are there in Article 2. They also care a lot about media freedom. They want to see all views represented in parliaments. And actually, a very large number also still want newcomers to their society to be treated equally. And you find these views not only in France and Germany, but also in Hungary and Poland, where the leading parties are arguing against a number of these values, are arguing that you don't need to have a press that is critical of the government, for example. But in fact, you find that Hungarians and Poles, when they're asked about these things, they do care about them.
Okay, now, one thing that sort of comes out of these findings is that typologizing people who support authoritarians or support populists just doesn't give us the full picture of what their deeper values are, of what their deeper thoughts are. It's almost as if typologies themselves, putting people into categories, is adding to polarization.
Contrary to the view that's often promoted by politicians in Europe, that there's a polarization. There are liberals and there are illiberals. There are those who want traditional liberal democracy, and there are those who want a new form of Christian democracy that's a lot more conservative. Actually, Europeans have much more moderate and much more mixed views about what's essential for a good society. So although the overwhelming majority definitely say we need media freedom, the media need to be able to criticize government, for example, at the same time, they want governments to, this is a substantial proportion of people, this is not the majority, but there is a substantial minority that also want the government to promote national cultural traditions, some harmony across society. So you see a mixture of these different things, and that's why it's very important that neither politicians nor civil society leaders just put people into categories and assume that some are unquestionably liberals and some are unquestioning illiberals. In fact, there's a mixture. There's everything to play for here. There's a real debate to be had.
If part of this project is about getting away from the typologies that in some ways feed polarization and reduce our ability to find common ground, isn't the entire rubric of open and closed slightly problematic?
So the term open society is one that's quite well understood by philosophers. It's part of the tradition of Western political philosophy. And of course, it was written up very powerfully by Karl Popper in his 1946 book, The Open Society and Its Enemies. But if you look across Europe, it has different meanings. In Germany, the idea of the offene Gesellschaft, the open society, has a lot of resonance. People recognize it, they understand it. But in France, they don't. It's not really used. People instead refer to republican values, you know, fraternité, égalité, liberté. So that's, you have to look quite carefully at what people actually think. And that's really what this project is all about. It wasn't about classifying people according to a fixed set. They were asked what their own views were when they were given a list of attributes which are associated with more open societies and attributes associated with more closed societies. And they were simply asked, which of these do you think are important, are very essential or essential for a good society? That's what they were asked about. And what you find is people sometimes have quite contradictory views. They both think that everybody should be able to express their opinion, that government critical groups and individuals should be able to engage in dialogue with the government. But at the same time, they also believe that the government must ensure media reporting always reflects a positive image of their country. Now, that's actually quite hard to deliver. And in most legal orders and in most constitutions, there is no requirement that the government ensures media reporting always reflects a positive image of the country. But people are human beings. They can hold these contradictory views. And so that's why it's important not to assume that there's a polarization in society and that there's no common ground, because many of the people, even who hold quite traditional conservative values, like, for example, everyone must respect the national values and norms of our country, they still believe in a lot of the values in Article 2 of the Treaty of European Union, for example, on the rights of minorities, on media freedom, on freedom of expression.
Okay, so what are the full implications of this richer picture that you're painting? And for the elections that are upcoming in Europe?
The implications of this research is that no politician should talk down to people and assume that they are either diehard conservatives or dyed-in-the-wool liberals. In fact, many people have a mixture of views. And it's especially important that the mainstream politicians don't assume that people who vote for populist parties simply don't care about liberal values anymore. They do. They overwhelmingly support them, even in Poland and Hungary, for example. Look at how 80% of Poles, for example, think that minority rights should be protected, and 70% believe that newcomers should be treated equally. Even in Hungary, where there's been a huge amount of government propaganda and vilifying of migrants, you see that Hungarians still actually care about treatment of minorities, and they still 90% want NGOs to be able to hold a dialogue with authorities, for example. So politicians shouldn't assume that people have one value set. They can have a range of different values, and there's a lot more common ground than the current polarization of political parties would lead you to believe. The common ground is there on values. It's just that we need to talk about them. You can't just refer to them in the abstract. I've been using terms like freedom of expression. What exactly does that mean? When you talk to people in terms of their daily lives, do you think you should be able to express your opinion on any subject at any time? Then that resonates with people. But you need to talk about these things.
For whom are these findings most useful?
The survey shows that Europeans care about values at a very deep level, and that they need to be talked to in terms that they understand about them. So in Italy, for example, where there's a strong polarization of politics, there aren't very many politicians talking about values openly to the public in ordinary, everyday language. So there's a hidden majority there waiting to be talked to about these issues. They do support values. They want to see them in their country. They want to see them practiced in everyday life. But very few politicians are engaging with them. In fact, it tends to be those on the extreme who are engaging on values and not those in the middle. So those in the middle need to reach out. They need to find that common ground which is waiting for them to occupy. And what they're failing to do is to understand that people may have contradictory views. They may not talk about things in the abstract terminology of political philosophy, but they still care about these values. They see them as essential for a good society. They're something they want to see practiced in their country.
So these findings open up political opportunity for centrists.
Yeah. So centrists have to understand, or moderates of the political center need to understand, that wishy-washy language about values is not going to get them very far. At the moment, they're allowing populists to occupy the ground of values and to be the only voices that are heard on these issues. A lot of what they claim about in our country, the majority needs to have more privileges, or newcomers don't need to have the same rights as anybody else, these are not actually views that are held by the majority of the population, but they are the ones which are dominating the headlines, dominating the political debate, even dominating social media. So it's time for moderate centrists and liberals to get out there and talk about values themselves. It simply means going out on the front foot instead of being constantly in defensive mode and allowing the populace to fill the ground of values with only the issue of migration. Migration is not the only values issue out there. There are plenty of others around media freedom, for example, around the right to practice your religion, over government critical groups being able to engage in dialogue with the government. People care about these things.
So if you're going to communicate that way, do you have to go through a more complex process? You know, instead of immediately talking about migrants, you would say, well, how do you feel about newcomers? I mean, in our age of instant media, of instant communication, I don't think the electorate has time for this kind of complex Socratic engagement with centrist politicians, or am I wrong?
it's not about complex Socratic engagement at all. It's about going out there in the public debate and talking about issues in everyday language. It's about talking about, do you want to live in a country where you can't express your opinion? Do you want to live in a country where the government controls all the media? Are you really attracted to the idea of living in a place where the parliament doesn't represent all political views? That's not what most Europeans think. They are not comfortable with the idea of living in essentially an increasingly authoritarian society, which is what would be created if you lose media freedom, you lose freedom of expression, and parliament starts to become just representing one set of views. So people don't want that. But the question is, do they see the connection between moves by certain politicians to, for example, buy up the media or to reduce the space for NGOs to operate, to reduce the dialogue between government and civil society?
Some of the findings in the reports focus to some degree on young Italians who have voted for far-right parties, but the evidence shows that they may not be xenophobic or racist per se, but more driven by economic despair. But here, and I don't mean to be a Cassandra here, but here, what are the opportunities when Italy has close to the highest debt levels to GDP in the entire world? I mean, there's not a kind of new dawn waiting in Italy, and yet some of your findings suggest that there is common ground if we can get prosperity, get the prosperity machine rolling again. But that machine ain't going to get rolling. No.
Many politicians, especially mainstream politicians, still seem to be assuming that the old adage of, oh, a bit of economic growth and a fall in unemployment will take all of our problems away and everything will be fine. This is just never going to work again, because growth in Europe is going to remain very slow, and it's time to reach out to people and talk about how the prosperity of Europe and future employment, particularly for the young, is going to depend on big adaptations to the major changes that are coming owing to digital transformation, owing to climate change, and that it's by working together through the European Union that Europeans can best manage these crises.
So what are the implications of your findings for communicating the virtues, and I use that term cautiously, the virtues of the European Union?
There's a very deep well of support for these values. The question is whether people want to see them enforced by the European Union or by some other body, or indeed by national governments. In many countries, people are still trusting, quite rightly, their national government to do that job. Germans are, for example, very fond of the Grundgesetz, the basic law, the German constitution, and they really trust it and they really value it. And it is a very solid law, and there's a very solid infrastructure of protection for values built on top of it. But we've seen in other countries that that infrastructure is much more fragile. The UK, for example, it's turned out to be much more fragile than it looked. Definitely in Hungary, it's not really been very robust at all. So at that point, you need to ask yourself, okay, does there have to be a supranational level of enforcement and protection of these values? If it is possible in some member states to ride roughshod over these values in ways that affect the others. And there I would see the really important added value of the European Union. The EU should come in on values questions, not across the board, but on where they have supranational implications, where they cross borders. Because the loss of media freedom in one country actually starts to affect how people react to, for example, the EU and the debates at EU level. The loss of judicial independence in one member state has a massive impact on the other member states, because their courts become reluctant, for example, to extradite people to that country if the courts are no longer independent there. It has a huge impact on the single market. So the EU needs to get involved in values on anything that crosses borders. I think that the next term of the EU institutions should have a constructive debate about values, because in fact, there's a huge amount of common ground among Europeans, as you can see from this work on public opinion.
That's EU Scream for this week. You can check our website at euscream.com for links to topics discussed in the show and for more episodes. Please rate us on iTunes, tweet about us at EU Screams, and like us on Facebook. EU Scream is edited and mixed by me, James Cantor. Tom Brooks and I produce the show.
Laura Natali plays our piano. Thanks for listening.